thanks to Rania for inviting us, and also to Indira, who I think gave a really fantastic presentation of the job guarantee, or what we're going to call employer of last resort program in India. I think that should be sufficient to convince anyone who is not trained in economics to support the program. I've been giving presentations on employer of last resort mostly to economists since 1994, and it is extremely difficult to convince economists that giving jobs to people is a good idea. And the first part of the presentation really is going to be explaining sort of the economics of the program. Then Paulina will take over and talk about the case of Argentina and focus in on the gender aspects. And then, assuming we don't run out of time, at the very end I'll say a few things about trying to design a program for developing nations. Now, I first heard about employer of last resort, which is Hyman Minsky's terminology. I'm sure you've heard his name before, very closely associated with the Levy Institute. And so we're continuing to use his terminology. I think it has some advantages. Rania mentioned lender of last resort, and so there is this nice symmetry to employer of last resort. Minsky is best known for financial instability. That's why his name appears everywhere right now. But he spent just as much time writing about employer of last resort, employment creation, and poverty elimination in the 1950s and 1960s, and it showed up all the time. I was a student beginning around 1980, and he is the one who introduced this idea to me. Minsky's program is a universal program, so it is a job guarantee program because it offers a job to anyone of legal working age. It provides a uniform compensation package. That is, the wages and benefits are the same for anyone employed in the program. So you don't pay higher to certain maybe high-skilled or male employees. Everyone gets the same package, and there's a reason for that. It takes workers as they are. So rather than telling people that first you got to get an education, first you have to have the proper level of training, then we'll think about giving you a job, you give them a job immediately, no matter what their level of education, no matter what their situation is. So it really is universal. And he used to say it is humiliating to tell someone that first you have to do this before we'll give you a job. No, you give them the job first, then you train them, then you bring up their level of education. So anyway, training needs to be a component of every job because you are trying to raise their skill levels and so on. Part of the reason for that is to increase their own feelings of self-worth, but also to make them more employable outside of this program. Workers do useful things. Two reasons for that. One, nobody wants to do something that's not useful. Everyone wants to feel like they're contributing to society. The second reason is that probably most members of society are not going to be in this program. They want to see that they're getting some benefit out of this program. And so the people working in the program need to do things of obvious benefit to society as a whole. And finally, the key aspect of this program, the reason why it will not have all of the scary outcomes that many economists claim that full employment has, is that it is a fixed price floating quantity model. The government doesn't go out and say, we're going to hire 2 million people and we'll pay whatever wage necessary to get people into the program. That would be inflationary, or could be inflationary. What the government does is says, okay, we're going to pay $10 an hour plus benefits, child care, retirement, all that stuff, and we'll hire anyone who wants to work at that. This cannot be inflationary. It cannot be. This is a matter of logics. Okay, I'll explain that in a bit. The quantity floats. This is what Indira was saying. In economic good times, the number of people in this program will go down. Why? Because they have a better alternative. They can work in the private sector. They can work at state and local governments outside this program. In bad economic times, they flow into the program. So that's why we say the quantity floats. This makes the government's budget countercyclical, which is exactly what you want. The budget will move toward a deficit. Maybe it's always in a deficit. Okay. Maybe it's always in surplus. But it's going to move toward a deficit in economic bad times. It will move toward a surplus in economic good times. Okay, why is it so hard to convince economists of this? They have three main objections. Every presentation I've ever given, I've gotten these three objections from the economists in the room. Without exception, no matter where in the world you talk about this program, you will get these three objections. The first is government can't afford it. It's an open-ended commitment. That is, floating quantity has to be open-ended. You hire anyone willing to work at the wage. So we're not saying we're only going to hire 3 million. No. If necessary, we're going to hire 50 million. So they say, oh, government can never afford that. Okay? Second problem, it will threaten macroeconomic stability, and what they really are referring to, if it's in the United States, it's always inflation. It's going to cause inflation. If it's outside the U.S., it's always currency depreciation. No, the currency will depreciate if we do this. Okay? And I'll come back to that in a second. And finally, program will be unmanageable. You can't possibly find enough useful things for people to do. Okay, these are obviously economists who don't get out enough. Okay, any one of you could easily go down to New York City and find a million jobs for people to do. Okay, but economists, they're not very creative or clever, and so for them, oh, how could you possibly find enough work for people to do? Corruption, Indira mentioned this. Okay, obviously. That could be a problem. And incorrigible workers. Well, if you offer anyone a job, how can you possibly make them work? Okay? So those are all practical things, and I'm going to leave it up to Pavlina to mostly deal with those when she talks about Argentina. But we also can talk more in questions and answers. I'm really going to focus on the first two things. So let's look at the macro stability question. So the argument in the United States, and everyone who studied economics knows this, that we have to have poverty and unemployment in order to keep prices down. So unemployment is the cost of avoiding inflation. Well, that's NIRU, the Phillips curve trade-off. Everyone who studied economics knows that. Outside the United States, it's always the exchange rate. We have to have unemployed and poor people to keep our currency strong. It's a shame, but it's necessary. That's always the argument I get every time I speak outside the U.S. In the United States, most economists don't worry much about the exchange rate. Maybe it's increasing a little bit, but we never even discussed it when I was a student in economics. The exchange rate just didn't matter. It was never discussed. But outside the U.S., that's it. Okay, well, there are two ways you can reply to that. The first is ethical. Let's say that those claims are true. Is that ethical? Should we require that 20% of the population has to be poor to keep inflation down and currency strong? I think there are very strong arguments against that. It's not an ethical position to hold at all. And the main reason for that is any country you go to in the world, within a few hours, you can identify who are going to be the unemployed and poor people. All of you know who it is in America, right? And you know who it is in your country. It is never an equally shared burden, never. It's always concentrated on the most disadvantaged people in society. So what you're saying is the most disadvantaged people in society have to be the ones to suffer to keep inflation down and the currency strong. That's not ethical, okay? We have to keep the currency strong so that the very advantaged people can afford vacations in Hawaii. That's not ethical, okay? But I'm not going to make that case. All of you can make that case if you want to. I think there's a stronger case that you can make. It's just not true. Employer of last resort will enhance macro stability. It's not going to cause instability. It will make your currency stronger. It is actually a very effective way of fighting inflation. So these arguments are just plain wrong. So let me first start with sheep, okay? And this actually comes from my colleague and co-author, Bill Mitchell, who I heard had a bit of a tough time here. Okay, I got ELR from Minsky, Bill Mitchell got it sitting in an agricultural economics class as an undergraduate. And he's learning about the sheep wool buffer stock program in Australia. Okay, what did the government do? The government says, well, sheep herding, production of wool is a very important commodity in Australia. And sheep farmers are a very important part of society. And what we want to do is stabilize their incomes. So they designed a program in which the government would buy wool at a floor price and sell it at a ceiling price. What does it do? It stabilizes the price of wool. That stabilizes the income of the sheep herders. Okay? That also stabilizes their consumption, which helps to stabilize the whole economy. If you have an economy that is really based on wool production, if you can stabilize the price of wool, you will stabilize that economy. Now, of course, over time, Australia diversified. It became a much less important program. And Bill tells me they've now ended this program. But he's sitting there in class, and he realizes what this program does. There was a guy named Benjamin Graham in the 1930s in America who designed a whole commodity buffer stock scheme where the government wouldn't stabilize just one commodity price. It would stabilize a whole basket of commodities. And that would help to stabilize the whole economy if you had a broad enough basket of commodities, commodities that went into the production of everything. Okay? And, of course, in the 1930s, they were just as worried about deflation as inflation. So they were trying to design a program to prevent both deflation and inflation. Well, the second thing that it does is it guarantees full employment of the commodity that's in the scheme. And Bill is sitting there thinking, oh, this is a full employment of sheep policy. He said, but do we really care if sheep are employed? Not that much. Why don't we make sure that workers are fully employed? Stabilizing the price of labor will have a much bigger impact on stabilizing the whole macroeconomy because labor goes into the production of everything, whereas sheep only go into the production of things that wool is used for. So if you can stabilize the price of labor, you can stabilize income, you can stabilize consumption, you can stabilize the whole economy. So all you can need to do is think of employer of last resort as a buffer stock program, just like the wool buffer stock program. And then all the same results fall out of it. The government hires labor at an ELR wage. That's the base wage. It sells it at any wage higher than that. Okay. A wage floor cannot pressure wages. This program cannot possibly cause wage inflation. All it does is set a floor price. It can't push them up. It provides an effective minimum wage. Minsky always used to ask the class, what is the minimum wage in the United States? And someone would raise their hand. It's $1.75. He said, no, it's not. It's zero. If you can't get a job, the minimum wage is zero. The only way you can have a minimum wage is with employer of last resort. Then it is the program wage. Otherwise, you get zero. It acts as a price anchor for the whole economy. Okay. Why? Because employers can always hire labor out of the program at just a little markup over the program wage. So it stabilizes wages. It doesn't push them up. It stabilizes wages, production costs, income, consumption, prices, and the currency. So it gives you macro stability, not instability. What about the exchange rate? Orthodox believes that full employment leads to an increase of imports, which leads to depreciation of the currency, which leads to inflation. Let's say that's true just for a second. Then we have to have a debate about the distributional effects of unemployment and of moving to full employment versus the benefits of full employment and the net real benefits of imports. Okay, in the Q&A, if necessary, I can talk more about this. Okay, but you can design your employer of last resort program so that it is not going to have a huge impact on net imports. And at the end, I'll get back to that. Furthermore, certainly for most nations, and I think actually it's true for all nations, the inflation effects of depreciation are a lot smaller than what people claim. Empirically, they're not as large as what is feared. Finally, exchange rate determination is complex. The economists here know that there are no models that can explain or predict exchange rates. There simply aren't any, okay? There's no evidence that net imports cause depreciation. Full employment could actually attract capital flows and cause appreciation rather than depreciation. And if program like this cause you to lose a budget surplus, there's no evidence that there's any link between budget surpluses and deficits and exchange rates. Okay, affordability. I'll be very quick because that's the topic for tonight. Can the government afford this program? I will argue tonight that a sovereign nation with a floating currency can always financially afford an employer of last resort program. At the end of the talk this afternoon, I'll come back to, well, what if you're not a nation with a sovereign currency that floats? I'll come back to that. In this sort of a nation, sovereign nation, government spends by crediting reserves, taxes by debiting reserves, deficits generate net reserve credits. That's all there is to the story. That's how the government spends. And there is no limit to its ability to do this. If it creates net reserve credits, as I'll explain tonight, it's probably going to sell some bonds in order to hit its interest rate target, but it can always do that. Okay, now finally, to lead into Pavlina, practical considerations. How can you implement the program? How can you properly administer it? How can you find useful work? Well, fortunately, we have good examples around the world of programs. And here, only talking about recent ones, but of course in the 1930s in the United States, we had the various New Deal programs. And if you look at any country in the world that achieves full employment on a more or less continuous basis, you will find job creation programs. There's no question about it. Why? Capitalist economies do not generate full employment. That's not what they do. Capitalists, as Anwar said the other day, are interested in profits, not in full employment. It's a sheer coincidence if they ever achieve full employment. So it has to be the government that does it. So anyway, there are a variety of programs that we can look to for examples of how you do this stuff. Pavlina.
Thanks. All right, so in the remaining minutes, I want to introduce you briefly to Argentina's program and talk about the research that's been done on Argentina and how that research has answered some of those questions about the macro effects, about the ELR features, as well as some of the criticisms of the ELR program. I also want to spend a little bit of time to report on results from field work that's been done by Randy and I, as well as several colleagues from UMKC and Columbia, and another one from Georgetown, to which I'm going to refer. And finally, the question in particular that concerns me is how do job guarantees improve gender outcomes, and how do they compare relative to income guarantees? And this actually ties into an earlier question. There is quite a bit of debate whether income guarantees and job guarantees deliver the same kind of outcomes for women. So I've dealt a little bit with that question. But very briefly, Argentina was the success story of IMF. So what happened? In 2001, they plunged into severe recession. Poverty and unemployment skyrocketed. IMF had a series of proposals which Argentina rejected. They defaulted on their foreign debt and finally implemented a public sector, public employment program as a main feature of their stabilization package. This experience is particularly instructive because the Argentinian program was in some ways designed after the ELR proposals developed in the United States, pushed by Labor Ministry economist Daniel Kotzer. Now, the program was up and running literally in a few months. and it provided 150 pesos per month for 4 hours of daily work to an unemployed head of household. 150 pesos was equivalent to 50% of the minimum wage at the time of implementation. Most heads of households participated in community services. They had small construction maintenance activities. There were also large-scale infrastructure projects that were done. They were also enrolled in training and education programs, finishing basic education. There were some eligibility criteria. It had to be children under the age of 18. It had to be an unemployed head of household, or they had to have a pregnant woman or a person with disability in the household. Nevertheless, one of the unexpected results of this program, although it is targeted to heads of household, is that a lot of women showed up for work. And what had happened is within the household, the woman was designated the head of household, whereby she was able to take the public sector employment, perhaps the logic being that the men still had better chances of getting employment in the informal sector. But what was interesting is that 64% of participants initially were women. Eventually, that actually increased to about 74% in 2005. And Randy and I and Jan Kregel, another scholar at the Levy Institute, were invited to visit some of these projects, evaluate the program, and look at some of the institutional features. And our intention was not to study gender effects of public service, but that emerged immediately as one of the main questions to address. What I also want to point out is that the budget did not explode. It didn't break the bank. It was only less than 1% of GDP, the cost of the program. And in fact, the government did run a surplus during the duration of the program. It employed 5% of the population and close to 14% of the labor force. It really was a very large-scale employment program. So what we have done so far, and I'd be happy to refer you to the literature, is that we have looked at the macroeconomic stabilization effects of this program. We have observed rapid and sustained growth, precipitous decline in unemployment rates, immediate reduction in extreme poverty, very large multiplier effects by conservative measures, 2.57. In addition, we have observed price stability and exchange rate stability. It is simply not the case that the large-scale program eroded the exchange rate or pushed depreciation. Now, we have also looked at how HFS mimics the ELR and whether it exhibits some of the ELR stabilization features. We have noted that it does indeed stabilize wages at the bottom. The government had collected data on how much HFS employees earn when they move transition into private sector work, and 97% of them get a wage above that of the HFS program. The buffer stock mechanism, we've also observed that people do not get stuck in the public sector. They actually do transition into private sector employment. Although the program ballooned very quickly, it also very quickly reduced. People left the program with time. We expect some to stay in the public sector. That is, in fact, part of the process of maintaining full employment. As far as the objectives, I already talked about affordability. About currency depreciation, the incorrigible workers, corruption, and useful activities. Yes, of course, there are some projects that are poorly managed, and so are many in the private sector. Nevertheless, we did observe that participants performed a lot of useful activities, from food kitchen to child care, elderly care, to landfill cleanup, to recycling efforts, to water irrigation. I'd be happy to talk about all of these different programs and give you specific examples in the Q&A. We also have found that the program was well targeted. It did indeed take workers as they are, and it captured those most in need. We've also looked at the overall impact on beneficiaries, and specifically as we visited, we wanted to see how women respond to their experience in this program. And very briefly, I want to discuss the issue of how you can actually see public employment programs as much more than simply programs for full employment. You could also see them as institutional instruments or as vehicles for improving gender outcomes, for environmental renewal, if you will. So it is a structured response to an economic problem that we observe. So how did this program compare to other programs in affecting women's lives? Now, this is the fieldwork that I was referring to. Randy and I have been to a couple of municipalities, Almirante Brown and Ciudad Oculta, which means the hidden city. It has, since the implementation of the HEFES program, changed its name. They no longer believe they're the hidden city. Corinne Pastoret and Marta Tepepa have gone to another municipality, Lomas de Zamora, have studied a different set of projects. And then there is Graciela de la Rosa, who has studied Morón province. De la Rosa and Randy and I have been particularly interested on the impact of HEFES on poor women. We have mostly observed immigrant workers with little former labor market experience, skilled workers who lost their jobs in the economic crisis, young and educated women from downwardly mobile neighborhoods that were not able to find employment opportunities. And as I said, some of the projects produced output that was sold in the market, some was distributed freely, free of charge. And as I said, large proportion of the participants were women, so were the supervisors, and so were their representatives at the Ministry of Labor. So basically at every level, women were involved in this program. Lots of pictures. I'm actually going to skip these. And I know there were subsistence farming projects that we visited, daycare centers, micro-enterprises, tailor shops, bakeries. They were training and education programs that were adjacent to each place of work, although we do believe that the training education component was far too small. All right, so very briefly, some of the findings here. We did find that those micro-enterprises produced low-cost quality products often made of recycled materials. We saw that the community projects provided useful services, goods and services, to poor neighborhoods. And importantly, income was not the main reason why women wanted to work. In our Q&A, we found that women wanted to work, they wanted more hours of work, and they did not want welfare. And this is, maybe it's not very modest to say, but a little prescient of us, because we were very curious to see whether women preferred traditional welfare programs to the work experience in HEFES, because the idea is, you know, you're coercing women to go into these public sector jobs to earn their income. And a few years later, there was a lot of talk about reform. The reform has actually taken place, and now the program is slowly being phased out into a traditional welfare program where women are coerced or moved or encouraged to leave the jobs program and enter a welfare program where they get cash support, but they are not given the opportunity to work. So why the reform? And I want to argue that it is indeed, you know, old paternalistic ideas of women's place and women's role in society that have driven the reform. So let me just say a few words about this reform. And this you can find in the legal documentation. Women are unproductive workers, unemployable. They're responsible for child rearing. This program artificially brings them into the labor market. They were perfectly happy being at home, taking care of their children, but now you are artificially activating them, and now you have to find them employment, right? So it's increasing the labor force. Now, familias, as I said, is welfare. It provides non-wage income. It is higher income than what HEFES provided to poor and uneducated mothers. It provides some funds for education and training for some seminars for those women. And it also has another component, funding for communication information strategy to explain the benefits to women and inform them of the available training opportunities, improve opinion of the welfare program, administrative oversight, and to implement easy and efficient transfer of HEFES into familias. So basically, the program is slowly phased out. Men traditionally are put into training and education and employment placement programs, women are encouraged to enter the Familias program and get higher pay and then an additional stipend per child. So the question here is, you know, how do women benefit from job guarantee programs relative to cash support programs? Here, I want to invoke the Amartya Sen and Martha Nisbaum approach of substantive freedom and the capabilities approach, which has been quite important in human development discussions and specifically discussions about equality and gender, improving gender outcomes. Now, my reading of the approach can be synthesized as follows. There are three conditions for providing substantive freedoms. The first one is you have to recognize what individuals want. And in the case of Argentina, it was very clear that women specifically wanted paid employment. The second condition is you have to provide those opportunities. A job guarantee does that. An income support does not. And finally, you have to remove obstacles for individuals to take advantage of those opportunities once they have been provided. And here, one of the major obstacles are care responsibilities. And I would refer you to Rania's paper, The Right to Work, The Right Kind of Jobs, that really fleshes this out in great detail, how job guarantees can indeed alleviate unpaid care responsibilities. And in the case of Argentina, it was indeed the case that women enrolled their kids in school, that the HEFES projects provided elder care, child care, after-school activities, services, support, all of these other sort of auxiliary services that will alleviate unpaid care burden. And so we attempt to socialize the care burden. So if we are comparing job guarantees to income guarantees, we can make the case that job guarantees, in fact, expand and enhance female agency. We make women agents of change, right? Not patients of development, if you will. They are actively engaged in the services, in the provision of the services from which they benefit. Job guarantees erode some paternalistic views of women's place in society and women's jobs. They do broaden the meaning of work. Dignity was discussed quite a bit earlier, and this is something that all surveys found, that women find much empowerment from paid work. In fact, from public sector paid work, in the case of Argentina is particular because the informal sector is quite large. A lot of women actually provide household help in the informal sector. And so for them it was a lot more empowering not to work in the informal sector but to work in the public sector. De La Rosa responds that the husband's attitudes changed slightly. Initially, women had to work to supplement the household income. Eventually, husbands were not too happy about their work in the public sector, but they learned to live with it. So you see, there is the existence of a job guarantee is allows recourse for women to actually, discuss with their husbands, their labor market participation. Had this job opportunity not been there, they would not have the same kind of bargaining chip. They find a lot more respect from the community, from their family members, from their children. These are very important aspects of the job guarantee program that an income support or a cash support simply does not provide. With respect to bargaining, probably it's in the next slide, but the job guarantee allows women to have power over their income, but also their output as well as their assets. The program in Argentina allowed women to start their own micro-enterprises, their own co-ops, so they could really manage their own resources. An income support perhaps allows you to manage the income, but when it's not earned income, maybe it's not you don't have the same kind of control over that resource. A lot of surveys report, well, a lot of surveys, in a lot of the respondents in the surveys said that job guarantee allows them to escape domesticity, and it was a relief from household chores, in fact. And so you could argue that rather than women being artificially activated into the labor market, that their domestic work is forced inactivity. Right? There's simply no other option. So it is, I like to think of it as pent-up demand for jobs that is invisible. And once you provide the job guarantee, this is the reason why women flood the labor market, because now the option is there. Now, part of the reform was driven by this double shift day, that you know, women have these responsibilities in the household. Now you have to make them earn their keep by going into the public sector. And that simply increases the double shift day. Corinne Pastoret and Marta Tepepa specifically asked this question and found that care responsibilities are not an obstacle to work, in part because of extended family and in part because HEFIS itself provided childcare, elder care, et cetera. So while women will do take more of the household responsibilities, it doesn't seem to be an obstacle to paid work. The reform is problematic, but nevertheless taking place. The World Bank commissioned a study to see how women would respond to this reform and whether they would move into the Familias program. So they commissioned the study in the Santa Fe region, and they found, they report, a disappointing 50% of women actually moved from HEFIS to Familias. And the recommendation was to step up PR efforts to explain to women how good this program is for them. So once again, policy seems to be driven not from by a recognition of this capabilities approach, but by old paternalistic views of what women should be doing and where is their place. Now, what Corinne and Marta specifically found is that even while the reform was taking place, and even though women were able to, well, eligible for the welfare program, because recall, welfare pays more money, so there's a monetary incentive to transition. Even though welfare paid more money, they still went back to work as long as the projects were still up and running. Once they were shut down, there was not that option. The reform recognize that women benefit from all the social services that are being provided through HEFIS. Nevertheless, they replace those services with traditional mainstream higher-wage public sector employees, which we very much encourage the expansion of public services, of course, but that removed the option of women to be actively engaged in the provision of those services. So again, we're converting women from agents of change to patients of change. And, I refer to the educational workshops. An educational workshop may be able to teach women about their civil, social, and political rights, but HEFIS allows them to exercise those rights. And you may learn about empowerment in the classroom, but HEFIS actually provides the tangible opportunity to empower. Once again, workshops for violence prevention, information about shelters and the abuse were all very much needed, but HEFIS had already begun to provide these. So the option was expansion of HEFIS as opposed to shutting those down and replacing them with more mainstream public sector services where the poor themselves cannot participate in that work. All right, I'm just going to conclude with this short video. This is a political activist. She is every HEFIS project had its representative or spokesperson that had an official position in the Ministry of Labor. She really synthesized the approach of the government very well. And let's see if it's going to play. So she says the government did a good job. They addressed the root of the problem and made decisions based on the needs of the people. I don't think so. This problem is like a pyramid, but they didn't look to the top. They went straight to the bottom. So essentially, okay, this is Minskian's bottom-up approach. if you want, if
we can. We can play some for you afterwards.
All right.
I can't watch it now.
We have lots of short clips.
Are you saying we cannot watch it now?
You can watch it.
We're running out of time.
That's it.
The clip you just saw—that's all she wanted to show right now.
Right, just a brief statement that it was this is the Minskian bottom-up approach that the woman synthesized so well for us. So I don't know if there's a little bit of time to talk about development.
3 minutes left. Okay. Very quick. All right. So I said that my first 15 minutes I was talking about a sovereign nation, and if we move to developing nations, I think Rania already mentioned the 1%, Paulina mentioned the 1%. You can have a job guarantee, a fairly big one, as Argentina's was. It comes out to be about 1% of GDP. That's affordable even on conventional criteria, without even getting into the stuff I'm going to talk about tonight. And then if you think about the multiplier impact, Paulina mentioned that the multiplier was about 2.5 in Argentina, the reduction of social and private costs of moving toward full employment, the useful output you get from the program, the net cost is minimal. Phil Harvey has a very nice book, 1989, where he estimated the net cost for implementing an actually much more expensive version of employer of last resort than the one that we're promoting, and it came out to be about zero for the United States. And then if you think about the program, it's socially stabilizing, politically stabilizing, and economically stabilizing, not destabilizing. Now, what if we take a country, let's say almost the worst case scenario? It's got a pegged exchange rate. A pegged exchange rate will reduce the sovereignty. It reduces the fiscal space. And I'll talk more about that tonight, why a floating currency gives you more fiscal space. In this worst case scenario, it could be that it has little output that it can sell in international markets. And it's not able to produce its own investment goods. Maybe it has limited competence to implement a large-scale program such as a universal job guarantee, and it has institutional constraints. And finally, it probably has a lot of monetary leakages. That is, if it increases employment and wages, a lot of that leaks out of the country in the form of imports and possibly purchases of foreign assets. And maybe there's a lot of inflation pass-through so that if the currency does depreciate, then they get inflation. Is it possible, even in the worst-case scenario, to design an employment program? I think that it is possible to do that. Okay, first, one of the ways you deal with the limited competency and just the whole scare factor and the possibility that it's going to cause inflation, currency depreciation, and so on, you can do a gradual phase-in. There's no reason why the program on day one has to be implemented all across the country and across all individuals or families that want to enter the program. So you can have a registration period. This is what Argentina did. You have to register by a certain date to get into the program. You can have a lottery. So you register, and then there's a lottery to choose who's going to get into the program. You can have individual communities propose projects and say, we can employ 20 people in this project, and then only communities that have come forward with good projects will get the funding to employ the people in those projects. So that's another way to gradually phase in the program. And that's sort of what India is doing, because people have the right to demand a job, but there has to be a project for them to work on. You can target the program. Again, this is what Argentina did. Heads of households only, rural poor, India, or in Brazil, they are proposing a program that would target just 10 big cities. So depending on where your employment problems are, if they're more rural, you could target that, more city, you can target that. How do you deal with the monetary leakages? Well, you can use non-money benefits. For example, Jimmy Carter's Habitat for Humanity let the people in the program build their own houses. Okay. And their benefit is they get a house out of the program. Let them grow their own food. We saw that in Argentina. Pavlina mentioned that. And part of their benefit is the food that they actually grow. Childcare provided by the program. So you can provide lots of benefit. Healthcare can be provided by the program too. Lots of benefits are provided non-monetary. That reduces the monetary leakages. You can limit the import content of the program. Labor intensive, this was mentioned, I think, by Rania earlier. If the problem is you can't produce machinery and tools, then you want labor-intensive projects so that you don't need to import a lot of capital. You can limit the import content of the kinds of projects. So you only choose projects that you can provision domestically rather than importing. You can have export-oriented products, projects. Going back to the earlier statement that if the problem is that your nation doesn't produce things for export, this is one way to develop export industries. And you can integrate the program with your development plan, and this is what Indira was talking about. So you make the job guarantee part of your development program by providing the infrastructure that you need. Okay, and now I'm done. Just my favorite quote from Keynes. John Maynard Keynes, General Theory. The conservative belief that there's some law of nature which prevents men and women, of course, from being employed, that it's rash to employ men, that it's financially sound to maintain a tenth of the population. Of course, here he's talking about developed nations, because in developing nations, it would be 50% of the population. In idleness is crazily improbable, the sort of thing which no man could believe who had not had his head fuddled with economics for years and years. We're done. Thank you.